Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're supposed to be those of Mike McNulty. And, of course, Mike's been with us on previous occasions. Certainly, gentlemen, I have the utmost of respect for. Mike had actually spent a great deal of time after the initial onslaught on Waco back in 1993, putting together a documentary called Waco, The Rules of Engagement. If you have never seen it, it's certainly one of the gripping, most gripping demonstrations of what really happened there. And, of course, the really skullduggery of high government officials were negotiating on one hand with the Davidians and had agreed to give them an additional 5 days to come out. And then, of course, planned the raid. And unfortunately, an awful lot of people died in the raid. Well, of course, when the smoldering ashes were gone through and they were the site was evaluated by the Texas Rangers and by the FBI, it was a feeling that this was the site of a homicide. And there was a homicide investigation because it was felt that the Davidians had been killed in cold blood, and many of them had. And so Mike deals with that in a second DVD put out called Waco, A New Revelation, and then a third DVD, which we carry, called The FLIR Project. Now, we have the DVD of Waco, The Rules of Engagement. We have the video of Waco, we have the DVD of Waco, A New Revelation. We have a video, Waco, The Rules of Engagement, and then we have the video of The FLIR Project. But Mike has been suddenly retired from that. He's trying to get on with his life, but he was good enough to agree to come on with us to talk about what really happened back in 1993, because, you see, high government officials lied to us. In fact, the man who was the federal prosecutor in that area who sent the Davidians to prison, and many of them received sentences of 15 to 40 years or more, why the prosecutor felt so badly about that he actually turned and actually helped Mike accumulate evidence which would show that the government had deceived the American people. And, of course, we can talk a little bit about what happened to the federal prosecutor, an honest man who tried to do what he thought was morally and legally right, and, of course, he came under tremendous pressure. But I'm getting ahead of the story. Mike knows it far better than I do. Mike McNulty, thank you so much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, I was sort of enjoying listening to you.
So I'm going to let you pick up the story. What intrigued you enough to spend, what did you do, invest 4 or 5 years of your life in this?
Oh, a little more like 13.
Okay, well, why did you do it? Why didn't you just sort of let it go? Well, it was one of those things, and why did you just put so much time and effort and so much of yourself into trying to get the truth out about what really happened in Waco?
Lies, videotape, and venom.
All right.
Lies, insofar as actually it was some individual's version of what they thought happened that sort of, I don't know, what kicked me off. A lady attorney claimed she had found some videotape that showed that the tanks had flamethrowers on them, and the evidence she offered was less than flimsy.
Now, that was Linda, somebody or other.
Yeah, somebody or another. And I looked at that, and, you know, here's the problem. There was something really going on, but it wasn't flamethrower tanks.
All right, fine. You have thoughts. Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Mike McNulty. All right, Mike, go ahead with the story.
Well, the flamethrower tanks sort of threw things off And it was so obvious when you saw the original footage that that wasn't the case. It really upset me that, you know, okay, something went on. I don't know what happened at that point. I have no idea. But it didn't feel right. It felt wrong. It reminded me of an incident that happened in 1836 in a little place called Hans Mill, Missouri, when the Missouri militia was turned loose by the assistant governor, lieutenant governor, against a bunch of religionists that had sort of ticked off the population of Missouri. And he cut them loose and said, I'm issuing an extermination order. You go find any of these folks and you can kill them.
Were those the Mormons?
Yes, exactly.
Right, okay.
And Hans Mill wound up with the inappropriate, illegal, immoral deaths of about 45 to 50 people, where the mounted militiamen came up on this group near a grist mill, herded them in, men and boys, into the grist mill, barred the doors, and then started firing inside into the interior of the grist mill. You know, no trial, no jury, just we're going to execute you, and that's what they did. Well, the whole impression, the feeling that existed at the time that the Waco incident happened, particularly April 19, 1993, left me with the impression that we were witnessing another Hans Mill massacre. Couldn't prove it, couldn't tell you how or why or what, just the feeling I had. And then when this Linda something came along and flaunted her absolute proof and evidence, it just ticked me off. Because it became obvious rather quickly that this was just bunkum. And a lot of people speculated that she was basically a government plant to sort of distort and muddy the waters, so to speak. And I don't know anything about that, but I know that what she attempted to do was totally bogus and wrong. So I went to a friend of mine at CBS who happened to be not only the originating network of the footage that Linda something used, but also he was the producer standing next to the camera as it was being filmed. And he was outraged by Linda Something's claims.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Mark Rinkholding. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest this evening is Mike McNulty. And Mike had really gotten very upset when there was a woman who claimed to be a lawyer who put out a film, and she claimed that there was a flamethrower in the front of the tanks. And a lot of people looked at the videos, and you couldn't tell what was going on there. It looked more like that they had some pink, insulation on the coming out of the front of the gun on the tank. But Mike was so concerned that what was going on that he actually went to the people at CBS who shot the footage that Linda, whatever her name was, had used, and talked to them about what really happened there. The final onslaught of the French Davidians that ended up with the death of 17 children and, well, I think about 68 some people died there that day. And a lot of them ended up with a bullet in the back of their head. We don't know how many, but a lot of the men did. And, well, anyway, I'm going to let Mike tell the story. Go ahead. Anyway, Chris, you then talked to the people at CBS who shot the film footage that Linda, somebody or other, had actually utilized. And so what happened at that point?
Well, apparently she picked it up off a satellite feed, and it was a rather well-weathered version of the footage. In other words, it was dumbed down by 5, 6, 7 generations. So it was really difficult to tell what was happening. But when I got a hold of my friend John Paxson at CBS, it turned out to be the producer, and he agreed to go up channels, get permission for me to look at the footage. So I did. And when I did, the first thing that I noticed was is that, no, that's not a flame. But what it is a piece of drywall that folds down over the front of the tank chassis, and the tank is bumping around over the ground as it's going forward and backward, and it catches some sunlight because the sun was ostensibly off to one side but behind the building. And you can clearly see that it's just sunlight glinting off of the drywall that had collapsed over the front of the tank. Well, once that was satisfied, then, you know, if you dumb it down five or six generations, it looks like something like might be flame, but the flame didn't behave as it should have. The alleged flame body just didn't behave the way flame should have in that circumstance, in terms of what flame looks like as a gelled gasoline mixture coming out of any kind of flamethrower device. Well, that being said, I went and looked at the rest of the footage, and at that time I noticed something that no one else had noticed before, and that was the amount of demolition, the amount of the building that was brought down, destroyed, dropped onto the ground. And I captured several images and laced them together and sent back a videotape back to CBS, thanked them for their time and effort, made a public announcement about, ain't flame, but noted that the demolition of the building was inappropriate when you considered that inside the building there were men, women, and little children. And if they were trying to get them to come out, you know, dropping a 2 to 4 story building down on their heads by demolishing it with these tanks wasn't the best way to encourage them to come out. That was a good way to create a circumstance that they would feel that they were done for and might react in a way you wouldn't want them to. So that's what started. The demolition of the building started the footage chase, so to speak. And initially we found enough other footage to where, from TV stations and the like, that we formulated the first film, Waco, The Rules of Engagement. And we had probably more to say in that film about the BATF raid on February 28th than in the follow-on film, Waco, A New Revelation.
No, it was fascinating. It was very well done. It was very professionally done. And it was a gripping presentation. What was a couple of hours, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a feature-length documentary film. I think the good thing about that was it was done by my it was directed and co-produced by my good friend Bill Gusecki, and he added for lack of a better term, a Hollywood flair to telling the story, and it became very emotional. And as in some context, as well, it should become emotional. It was a little more emotional for my taste than I cared for, but I wasn't involved with the editing of the final cut. The final cut was edited with William and the executive producer. But overall, you know, I'm proud of it. I think it told an important story. I wished that more time had passed and we'd had more access to what I came into later, about a year and a half after the release of Waco, The Rules of Engagement.
Now, I think that people have to understand, in the meantime, there was a trial there, and of course this trial, the Davidians were tried, and I talked to Sarah Bain, who is the head of the jury, chairman of the jury, president of the jury that tried the Davidians, and she told me, the wrong people were on trial. It was the government that was responsible. We didn't want, of course, to convict the Davidians of anything. I mean, it was very obvious to her that the government had fired first and started killing the Davidians, and they were simply acting in self-defense, but we couldn't let the American people know that. We had to demonize the Davidians. We had to justify that government's good, the people are bad, they were all perverts, molesting little children, and Koresh was an evil guy, and he may very well have been an evil guy, but that doesn't justify killing the women and children. But they had, of course, to blame the Davidians, and certainly not blame anybody in government.
My favorite line in that whole business at the time was that when you look at the end result with all the dead women and children, was that I thought they stopped burning heretics, religious or social heretics, at the stake with their women and children in the 12th century. But apparently they haven't discontinued that practice. And I think that's the point. In my opinion, today, the federal government had an absolute duty to secure the safety of the children, and for that matter, the other adults in the building who did not have a warrant sworn out against them. In the original episode, the only two people that had a warrant sworn out against them was David Koresh and his business manager, who actually on February 28th wasn't even in the building.
And I think the significant thing was they could have arrested David Koresh any day. He went out jogging. In fact, David Koresh had actually invited the BATF to come and examine the building. He would have let them in. They did not want a peaceful solution. They wanted to stage something so they could get, you know, better appropriation for the BATF. They had the cameras were there. The news was there. Everybody was there. It was a staged event, and it went wrong. And, of course, eventually it's all BATF backing away with their hands up in the air, pleading not to be shot. And then, of course, they were going to wreak their revenge on the women and children as a result of it. Go ahead.
Well, I think the bottom line with the BATF was what the FBI had to say about it, and that was, here we go again. They just finished, weeks before, concluding an episode that was initiated by the BATF at Ruby Ridge, and that resulted in the death of Sammy and the wife of Randy Weaver, Mrs. Weaver. And Sammy was his son. And, you know, and the wounding of Randy and his friend. And that was just weeks before. And so here they are now at Waco, some weeks later, cleaning up another BATF mess that was even bigger than Ruby Ridge. And it got to the point where the FBI, as what I thought was appropriate, was just thoroughly disgusted with the activities and the policies and the actions of the BATF. Well, but the problem was now we had four dead ATF agents. And, you know, I mean, that's a point of distinction, for example, a major point of distinction between what happened at Mount Carmel in 1993 and what happened at the FLDS church here in Texas just a few months ago. Fortunately, there was no gunplay at the FLDS facility, although there's many premises going on here that I thought were very similar to the way that government, quote-unquote, dealt with a religious group. But fortunately, so far, there hasn't been any violence in the FLDS situation, other than the violence that was inflicted by the state on the 400-plus children that were now, as we find out, were illegally removed from their parents and their homes. So, you know, what I'd like to know is what happens when government screws up like that and the judiciary comes back and says, you guys screwed up. I would hope that those folks at the FLDS church wind up suing the state of Texas and the Department of Child Welfare or whatever it is. And, you know, make an example of them. And I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with the posture or position of the FLDS folks and their religious beliefs, but the government doesn't have the right to be cavalier with the lives of people's children.
Well, of course, the trouble is, Mike, what they do is simply they pay the people off. They give them up. I was just reading where, of course, some of the people who were arrested right after the 9/11 attack, there were about 1,000 Muslims that were taken in and tortured, you know, kept in isolation, wouldn't allow them to sleep. 1,000 Muslims right after 9/11. One of them sued, got $300,000, and another one's taking the case to court for gross mistreatment. And then they were all let go. They hadn't done anything at all. None of them were criminals. But, you know, the thing is that the people who commit the crimes are never punished. They simply pay the taxpayers money to silence the people who are making a fuss. But the people responsible, the people who make decisions, the people who advocate torture of helpless and innocent people, they get off scot-free. And there's something seriously wrong, ladies and gentlemen. What's happened to the soul of America? Well, we'll be back in just a moment with Mike McNulty and tell you the real story of Waco. Go right ahead, Mike.
Well, I'm not pressure where I'm supposed to go.
Where I'm supposed to go is, how does it happen that you did the second story, the second video?
Well, the second film came about after we finished production and release of the first film. You know, when you develop contacts and information sources, you finish a film production because, you know, the film needs to be completed and released and released to the public. But that doesn't mean that people stop talking about what they know or things about what they know. And so we continue to get information. And by that point, all of the criminal proceedings against the Davidians have been finalized. The appeals had run their course. Interestingly enough, one appeal went all the way up to the Supreme Court of the land, and it had to do with the extra sentencing time that Judge Walter Smith heaped upon the heads of the Branch Davidians, the 40 years plus on many of them. And that was appealed up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court got it, and all nine of the justices voted to direct the judge to drop that extra additional sentencing because of the way he dealt with it and the way he handled it, and that it was just totally wrong. So that was a minor victory. I think that if they had had a judge other than Walter Smith, that in fact I think they all would have been acquitted. Somebody who would have given better instructions to the jury, that's for sure, just on a technical point. But after that happened, all the criminal case evidence had been gathered and was retained by the Texas Rangers, who had started to conduct a criminal investigation at the behest of the governor of the state of Texas at that time, Ann Richards. And some time went by. The evidence just sort of sat there for a little bit, and things didn't happen that should have happened. And so I started poking around with the Texas Rangers. And found a couple of them, a couple of captains of Texas Rangers. One was the chief captain of Rangers, David Burns, and the other was Maurice Cook, who actually conducted the investigation. And by that time, 1995, we were in Washington, D.C., and we started the film Waco, the Rules of Engagement. And some things caught my eye during the course of the congressional hearings that were being conducted. And one of those things that caught my eye was the Texas Rangers. Those boys knew some stuff, and it was really interesting to watch the members of the Democratic Party on the committee that was conducting the investigation manipulate these guys and keep them from saying what they wanted to. They start to let them tell their story, and then, like an overzealous talk radio show host, they'd say, "Oh, but we got to take a commercial right now," and they would just drag these poor guys around in circles. And while the Rangers are pretty savvy guys, getting up and testifying in front of a congressional committee and having them all playing games with you can be pretty daunting. So the information that they really wanted to give, which led to an area that the congressional committee did not want to go to, was the question, why were they told to stand down by their governor, Ann Richards, in their investigation, and who was the ultimate authority? They didn't believe for a minute that it was Janet Reno. Who was the ultimate authority?
Hold on, Phil. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, I asked Mike, why did you continue with this? What was it that happened after you had done the first film, the Waco, the Rules of Engagement, that caused you to want to go on and produce a second production? Well, of course, one of the things was that the Texas Rangers were called before the congressional committee that you may have seen televised at that time, and they wanted to get the truth out about what they knew, and they were never allowed to do it. The congressmen were not about to have public revelation about what the Texas Rangers knew or what they suspected, had actually transpired. They did not believe, of course, that the decision to go in and kill the people was made by Janet Reno. She said, "Oh, I'm responsible. Well, you know, 60 people, 65 people are dead, 17 little children are dead, and all we get is, I'm responsible, But, of course, there's a lot of other questions, because, of course, there was an evidence room, there was all the evidence there, and when Mike eventually got into that evidence room, he found that the government had lied to the American people about the use of explosive and pyrotechnic munitions to actually start the fire. And, of course, it was those Davidians. They wanted to burn themselves up. They wanted to burn all the little children. Oh, my goodness, they're just terrible, terrible, terrible people. But, of course, that wasn't the story at all. So you pick the story up from there, Mike.
Well, going back a moment to the Texas Rangers when they were trying to give their testimony, they kept getting the runaround. And, we just ran out of time for this segment, so thank you very much, Rangers. Adios. And that's exactly the way they were treated, and it really sort of rankled them. So, over a period of time, of course, we went into other areas and tracked down all the areas that we could run down, and that resulted in the making of the first film. But time passed, and I got to know Captain Cook pretty good. And over the course of time of bouncing around Texas from here and there, we had occasion to have some great fajita dinners in Austin a couple of times, and just talk about stuff and how they felt, and let them get stuff off their chest. Well, there wasn't any more time left to add anything to the first film. We were done, and so about the time of the Oscars, a fella here in Fort Collins, Colorado, came to me, Rick Van Vliet, and his son, Jason, and asked me, well, is there anything more to the story? And I said, well, yeah, there's a lot more, but, we'd have to do another feature film to tell the story. I said, well, we'd like to do that. Oh, okay. So we started up on production of a little thing that became known as Waco, A New Revelation. And one of the first things we did was we went to those Rangers again, and that was some of the first interviews that we did. And then the very next thing we did was talk with our friend Bill Johnston, the assistant U.S. attorney who was the prosecutor in the Davidian case, and found out that all the evidence was being held in the Texas Ranger locker at their headquarters in Austin. And we asked, well, can we have some reasons to believe, after having talked to some of the criminal defense team for the Davidians, and looking through their files, we found evidence of the existence of pyrotechnic devices by way of documents and photos. And that we would like to go into the evidence locker and see if indeed there are some pyrotechnic devices left in the rubble and that matches these photos. Well, we walked into with Bill Johnson and a couple of Texas Rangers, and the answer, of course, was yes, you can. And he took us in, and it was hotter than blazes in August, as I remember it. And the evidence locker reeked of rotting flesh and CS gas, which just irritated the boogers out of you, burned your skin, and, oh, man, made your eyes water, and it was hotter than Hades, and you were sweating like a pig. And it was a very unpleasant time. But we started going through this evidence. And as we walked through the door, we first entered the evidence locker. I kicked a cardboard box that was, in the entryway. And in the cardboard box was a treasure trove of high-resolution videotapes that had been made by the Texas Rangers and the FBI and the ATF of the actual happenings of February 28th and April 19th, and time in between. So they became a source for much information and much footage in Waco, A New Revelation.
And then, of course, didn't you find some pyrotechnic grenades of some sort there?
Well, I was getting to that. I just heard some music playing in the background there, and wondered if we were going to have a little break.
We're going to have a little break, but we got about 30 seconds, 20 seconds now.
Well, I'll set it up then. I also had some sources that I developed that had a great deal of expertise in explosives and pyrotechnic devices, particularly the type that the FBI hostage rescue team is or was alleged to have used. And
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, Mike. You were saying you you were looking for these pyrotechnic devices that you suggested that the government had lied. They said they did not use anything of that sort. That they couldn't possibly have started the fire.
That up to that time, that was their position.
Right.
And we knew by secondary evidence, photographs and descriptions in documents, that there were at least three other types of pyrotechnic devices. As it turned out, there were going to be four. And one particular device was not pyrotechnic, it was explosive. What we discovered was that our experts that we brought with us, one of them happens to have been the chief explosives expert for the FBI crime lab itself, Dr. Fred Whitehurst. And the other party that we brought with us was Colonel Jack Frost, who, he's an older gentleman. He was a P-51 pilot during World War II. But he was also an explosives expert. And it turns out that he had actually been the source of the manufactured pyrotechnic devices that the FBI hostage rescue team had used on other occasions and on this particular occasion. And he had manufactured what are called penetrating stun munitions, which are 40-millimeter grenades that have a hollow cavity in the nose and are filled with an explosive charge of a certain level. And when they go through doors, windows, walls, they get to the other side and then they do the flashbang routine with a loud explosive report and a bright blinding flash. The problem with them is that when you fire through a wall, you don't have any idea what's on the other side. And these devices, in their normal charge capacity, with a normal charge as developed by our friend Jack Frost, if they were too close to an individual, they could maim or kill, definitely. These charges in these devices, however, upon his examination, his preliminary examination determined that they had additional explosive material put into them by the FBI. They'd been altered as per what he had originally sold them. And he would be the fellow to know. So we sent them off to a lab and got some chemical analysis done of material that he had recovered from the opening of these black projectiles.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Mike McNulty, who had spent some 13 years studying what happened at Waco. And when they finally got into the evidence locker, which, of course, nobody had been in before, but they were there, and, in fact, the assistant attorney general who'd actually tried the divisions was with them because he felt that there may have been a miscarriage of justice, and he was part of it, and I think he was trying to do what was right. They go in the evidence locker, they find, and of course they have two explosive experts with them. One is Dr. Fred Whitehurst of the FBI. The other is a retired colonel who had actually developed something called the flashbang grenade. But of course, what they found was that the grenades that the FBI had used there at Waco had been altered from the original design. And how had they been altered? What was done to those grenades that they used there at Waco on the women and children that was so different than originally was intended?
Basically, the explosive charge is usually a quarter stick of dynamite equivalent, which is pretty powerful. These were somewhere between the quarter stick amount and a half a stick. And the heat generated by that amount of explosives in the aluminum structure of the projectile caused some melting in the detonation chamber, which indicated that there was other materials as well as more explosive placed into the chamber. The idea was to stun to the point to where the person that was stunned by the so-called penetrating stun munition would suffer the consequences of shock and probably go into shock and die if it didn't strike them and or the explosive didn't occur close enough to them to actually maim and or kill. We found physical evidence of several of these, and we found the physical presence of two of these projectiles. We then found the photographic evidence of U.S. military, Army, pyrotechnic CS gas grenades. However, we could not find the corresponding physical empty projectiles that should have been in evidence. Somebody had removed them. Ha, ha, ha. They missed the others. Then we found an additional device in evidence. Actually, we found, I believe it was 6 or 8 of them. And these are DevTech 25s. These are hand-thrown flashbang devices, the bodies of which look, oh, sort of like a silencer from a pistol, an oversized silencer. The problem was they were made with heavy-gauge armor plate, and they were very heavy. They weighed a couple of pounds apiece, empty. And interestingly enough, when we discovered these in the evidence chain, we looked at the Texas Rangers GPS plot to show exactly where each piece of evidence was found in the compound, or the rubble of the compound. And what was interesting was is that we found these devices at precisely the 3 points of origin of the fire that the government identified. We identified 5. But these particular devices were found at each of these locations. But they were mismarked in the evidence chain when they were collected by the FBI as silencers. And that's really curious because somehow that helped them be overlooked by the arson investigation. And the fact that these pyrotechnic devices belonging to the government were found at the points of origin of the fire certainly cast some suspicion as to the involvement of the government in the starting of the fire itself. The difficulty was is that, again, they'd been mismarked. They had not been brought forward in the arson investigation. They were totally ignored. And the only thing that came forth in the arson investigation was the presence of flammables at these points of origin of the fire. But it didn't identify a source of ignition, in this case, the pyrotechnic devices. So that's 3 different types of pyrotechnic devices. And I'm emphasizing this for a reason because of what happens later. And then we found a fourth type of pyrotechnic that wasn't a pyrotechnic. It was a high explosive. We found evidence that said that the commander at Fort Hood in Texas had supplied the HRT and the Delta Force troopers that were present at Waco on April the 19th with at least 2 Mark 19 40-millimeter automatic grenade launchers and 200 rounds of high-explosive fragmentation grenades.
And I think what's so significant is the fact that it is against the law, the only way that you could actually have the Delta Forces used against American citizens, these are special forces, highly trained killers, would be for the president to give that permission, because this is a violation of posse comitatus. Only the president could give actual permission for that. Would that be right?
That would be true, but you're also getting ahead of me in the story now.
Go right ahead.
The other significant issue that needs to be noted here is the fact that there were 4, count them, 4 different types of pyrotechnic or explosive munitions used by the federal government. When Janet Reno was first told about all this stuff, her cover story became very simply that there was only these 2 military CS gas grenades that were used. And she pointed to those and ignored the fact, as we tried to protest, but the media wouldn't pay attention, that there were at least 2 to 3 other types of pyrotechnic devices that were also in evidence at other locations in the building, not outside the building, as Janet Reno. I mean, you know, it's sort of like a little kid that got caught with a cookie jar. And he points to his brother Billy, who has a cookie hanging halfway out of his mouth, and he says, well, Billy did it, but he's holding the cookie jar, right? So the issue became one of the media not doing its job once again, rather well done on the part of the media, and Janet simply doing what she does best, standing up and protecting the FBI and the president and the Justice Department from any further review. So at that particular point, she defused the situation by then appointing a former Republican senator by the name of Jack Danforth from Missouri as the legal counsel for the review of all the evidence of the Waco incident. And, of course, the media then insisted that everybody had to stand around on their hands and wait and not ask any further questions, no inquiries by the press or others, like myself, would be tolerated until the great Jack Danforth did his thing, which he did. He dug a very nice grave and placed the remains of the Waco evidence into it and covered it up promptly and thoroughly. So that's the way that went. And interestingly enough, we had people on scene, and we managed to gather enough evidence to be able to prove that Senator Danforth basically had committed a cover-up. And we showed precisely and scientifically how he had done that. And all that was composited into a little 35-minute short film called The FLIR Project. And unfortunately, though, the media wouldn't have any of it, and they became the final arbitrators of this whole thing. The Clinton administration waved the magic wand over it and said, case closed, we're done, thank you, as Jack Danforth pronounced the completion of the burial of the whole Waco issue with the culmination of his report. Well, for those that have not been able to see Waco, A New Revelation, I would invite you to take advantage of the opportunity that Dr. Stan has for you. Get a copy of the DVD, and you watch it, and you decide if the flashes on the FLIR tape, for example, are gunfire. If indeed it appears to you that the evidence has been tampered with in its gathering in the rubble, and many, many other issues. There's one other that I would like to touch on, and that is the involvement. You recall I mentioned that the Texas Rangers were trying to expose the direct involvement of the higher-ups in the Clinton administration above Janet Reno. And they were not allowed to. Well, we dug into that, and what we found is that another congressional committee, a Senate subcommittee on the Whitewater affair, had dug into the demise of one of the White House staff, one Vincent Foster. And it turns out that the Texas Rangers had really complained bitterly to the Justice Department about what was going on, and the White House, through some FBI agents, had interjected itself into this discussion. And the two Texas Rangers were told and were trying to tell the congressional committee that they appeared before the name of the individual they were given if they had problems with the way their investigation was being dealt with by the FBI. And the net result was that person's name was Vincent Foster. So we looked into the Senate investigation into the Whitewater hearing evidence and found that indeed, according to the testimony of Foster's staff, that two individuals had gone into Mr. Foster's office the night of his death, the very night of his death, and against the demands of the FBI to secure the office so that it could be properly investigated, these two individuals went into Mr. Foster's office and removed armfuls of files, as witnessed by a Secret Service agent that very night, sometime after midnight. And the two individuals were Mr. Bernie Nussbaum, the presidential counsel, who had been given the orders by the FBI to seal and secure the office, but also Maggie Williams, the chief of staff of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And they removed these documents, and the significance of that is there was one document that was referred to repeatedly in testimony by Foster's staff as ultimately described as a letter of resignation and an outline of the involvement of the White House in the Waco affair in the endgame on April the 19th. That document was never found by the FBI when they examined Foster's records. And it has to be presumed that it was removed with other documents that were removed by Maggie Williams, the chief of staff of Mrs. Hillary Rodham Clinton. And at that particular juncture, we have the testimony of a young man who was an intern for Mr. Foster. And he was tagged by Mrs. Williams a few days after the removal of the records. They were put into a box, and he was tasked with carrying that box in the company of Miss Williams up to the presidential private living quarters up on the second floor. And there, he personally handed that box to Hillary Clinton, delivered them to her.
Is that the same Hillary Clinton who has been running for the presidency of the United States?
Well, that seems to be the same one.
Right, isn't that interesting?
Well, it's also the same one who we have requested repeatedly FOIA requests for those documents and other documents such as the presidential directive ordering the Delta Force operators to go to Waco.
Now, of course, these are professional killers. Delta Force are highly trained murderers. I mean, they're trained as assassins. They're trained as to be killers. And they were sent to Waco in violation of the Posse Comitatus law. It could only have occurred with the permission of the President of the United States. But they couldn't let that come out. And very, very few Americans even are aware of the fact that there were Delta Force's personnel there.
Well, the way we
killers, and they were not there simply to watch and see what was happening. They were involved themselves, as you'll
find. The way we got that information about Delta Force was we had a Delta Force operator come to us, and he appears in the film, Staff Sergeant Stephen Berry. He was a sniper trainer. And he came forward and took footage that we had acquired in the evidence locker showing Delta Force operators clearly present and in the aftermath of the fire, standing around and joking with the HRT individuals. And the whole thing got pretty bad after a while. We found photographs that were posed with a charred corpse by several members of the hostage rescue team that were snipers holding their sniper rifles. And really grisly. Same corpse, same pose, different players in three or four or five different photographs.
So they're celebrating the charred body.
Well, what one might do with their first deer kill or something on a deer hunt. But in this case, it was a human being. Happened to be an elderly gentleman who was shot, wounded, and wound up dying in the fire that day. The upshot of it is that in the civil trial, was the only time, because the Congressional Committee wasn't allowed to talk to the Delta Force people. Just flat out weren't allowed to do it. So the issue was never resolved there. The criminal trial, the issue was never even raised that they were there, much less were they discussed or talked with or interrogated. But in the civil trial, it was discovered that there were 14 Delta Force operators with attendant support staff that were there and operational. In Waco, A New Revelation, Staff Sergeant Berry verifies this because he took the footage of these guys and showed it to these guys and some of their compatriots and got confirmation that that was them there at that time, that they were forward deployed and pulling triggers, I believe was the phrase that he used.
Pulling and triggers, so mean you're shooting at people.
That's right. They were there to do their deal as Delta Force operators. And To get additional confirmation, we found another independent source who was a now retired CIA operator who had contact with the Delta Force operators, the very same Delta Force operators that had been at Waco. He came in contact with them some months later in Mogadishu, Somalia in October, and talked to them and confirmed that they were the guys that were there and they knew what happened because they were the ones pulling the triggers.
And, of course, weren't they some of those of part of that tragic situation with Black Hawk Down where a number of American military personnel died there in Mogadishu?
Indeed, and some of them were Delta Force operators, indeed.
So when you play, down and dirty, why, sometimes they have to eliminate all the evidence. And if you ever studied what really happened with Black Hawk Down, you realize, of course, that this had to be authorized out of Washington, D.C. They were under United Nations command. They went around the chain of command, which you never do. And they went in, of course, on more or less what turned out to be a suicide mission for a lot of Americans.
Well, indeed, the commander of the Delta Force operators, a colonel, is portrayed in the film. And he's portrayed somewhat heroically. But according to the Delta Force folks that we had communications with after the fact, He took his men through an ambush of Somalis on the way to the location where they were supposed to rescue the people that had been shot down in the helicopter. And they got backed up and surrounded, and he was ordered to go back the same route he had taken. But instead of protesting and pointing out that that was an ambush they'd already been through and they don't need to go through it again, he followed orders like a good Nazi and took off back through the same ambush and got more men killed.
I wonder how many of the Delta Force that were there at Waco killing the women and children died in Mogadishu. Is that the way? We never will know, of course. Well, our guest has been Mike McNulty. The DVD, Waco, A New Revelation, we do have it. You need to see it. You need to weep. 17 little children and all the women were killed. Well, Mike, why don't you go ahead and you got 3 minutes with this hour, and then we'll go on to the next hour. But go ahead and tell the story as best you can.
I think people ask why is Waco important to remember? Over and above the obvious of the continued political involvement of some of the major players like Mrs. Clinton, who needs to stand in judgment relative to what her role was at Waco, and those documents need to be released. There's also the issue of just simple justice. While David Koresh was not a saint, he wasn't worthy of assassination. And in my opinion, what happened there was an assassination. And unfortunately, the women and the children and the other men that were with him had to suffer the same consequences, because you start doing that kind of thing, you don't leave witnesses. And that's my opinion as to what happened. Witnesses were not left. They were eliminated. So it's important for people to see this film in the context of today, in the context of what's going on in Texas with the FLDS Church and the removal by state authorities of all their children, because that was a central issue in what was going on at Waco, Texas as well. And frankly, I'm just amazed that the Texas authorities didn't learn more from that experience than to get sucked in by a phony phone call and get put up against the wall by the judiciary system for making such a stupid move as to basing their judgments as to what was going on a false report.
But they knew it was a false report, and they went ahead anyway. That was the thing.
Well, I don't know that.
Well,
what I do know was that they did find out during the course of events, and they didn't back down.
Right.
It's like they couldn't. Their egos were in the way. That gets people killed.
Okay, go right ahead. And so basically, of course, we have this tragic situation there. We have the special forces there. And, of course, in the next hour, we're going to talk about one of the things, apparently, that the special forces did, because, of course, the women and the children were in enclosed silo there, some sort of a
Church records vault.
Okay, a church records vault. And of course, there was an explosive charge placed on the roof of that vault. And, of course, well, I'm going to let Mike tell the story because he knows it far better than I do. But the women and the children, 17 little children, the women all died. And nobody's ever held responsible. Oh, it was just a mistake, sort of like our going to war in Iraq. It was just a mistake. We feel very badly about all the people who've been killed and all the Americans who've been killed and all the Americans who've been killed in Afghanistan, but we never count them along with the people that have been killed in Iraq and all those whose lives have been destroyed, whose minds have been destroyed. About at least a third of the men coming back. We'll be back here in just a moment with Mike McNulty to wrap up tonight's program here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, our guest this evening has been Mike McNulty. We do have the DVDs we've talked about. The DVD, it's a video, Waco, The Rules of Engagement. We have the DVD, Waco, A New Revelation. Then we have the DVD, The FLIR Project, which was one that Mike put together later on to actually demonstrate that what you actually saw on the films was gunshots. Senator Danford didn't want to believe that. Senator Danford was sent there not to reveal the truth, but to conceal the truth. We have 2 4-tape sets on Waco. I think they're an important part of history. My interviews with people who were intimately involved with what happened, with some of the Davidians themselves. You'll actually hear the Davidians talking about what happened, of course, during the day of the attack and how they barely escaped with their lives. And, well, of course, maybe it was they weren't supposed to get out. And then, of course, the total mistreatment of the Davidians and being sent to prison, some of them for 40 years, when the woman who headed the jury, and we actually talked to Sarah Bain, who told me the wrong people were on trial. They heard the evidence. They didn't want to convict the Davidians. They wanted to convict people from the government. But, of course, people from the government are never convicted. They always get off. It's only the innocent, of course, who are sent to prison. That's why in today in America, one in every 33 adults, one in every 33 adults in the United States is in prison, probation, or parole today. Is that the what happens in a free society, ladies and gentlemen? In communist China, with a population almost four times ours, they have at the present time about 1.6 million people in prison. We have about 2.3 million people in prison today. Why is there such a difference? Well, because nothing is that appears to be. And there are really, of course, an awful lot of people in prison today who should not be there. In fact, here in California, we've got so many prisoners, we're having to shift them to other states. And how many of those people are innocent and have been railroaded in by improper prosecution? Ladies and gentlemen, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And you need to know what happened at Waco, because Waco preceded the bombing at the Murrah Building just 2 years later, on the same day as the Waco onslaught. And then the following year, there was the downing of TW-800, and almost 200 people saw the missiles go up and take the plane down, and the government denied it occurred. And when they had their hearings, none of the witnesses were ever allowed to testify. And then, of course, we had September 11th. And have they told the truth about September 11th? Well, that's another subject, but the important thing is we hope many of you will want to get the DVDs and the videos about Waco, because this is the foundation, and we got the truth out about Waco. Why, I do not believe we would have the bombing of the Murrah Building or the downing of Flight 800, TW-800, or I do not believe that the events that took place on September 11th would have taken place. Or we might have been able to get the truth. But they, you see, they can do whatever they want to, because they are above the law. The videos, Waco, A New Revelation video, Waco, A New Revelation DVD, the FLIR project is a VHS. So they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we hope that you'll want to get our four tape sets. And they're only available in tapes at this time because, of course, they were taken a long, long time ago. But they are an important part of history. So, again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. And then to put things into their proper perspective from a spiritual point of view, let me suggest my DVD, The Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get that with a book, which will give you all the documentation for what we say. My talk on the forbidden secret, and you need to get the syllabus that comes with that. My talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that comes with that. All of these things are available from Radio Liberty. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can watch our DVDs. They're up there. Many of these you can see for nothing. We have a new section called Other DVDs, and we're posting the links to important DVDs that you need to see to understand what's really going on. And then, of course, listen to our radio programs there. You can hear them live 4 hours a day, or archived, or MP3. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, because we're on the front line of a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Our guest this evening is Michael McNulty for the second hour, and we're going to let Mike go ahead and tell you the story as it unfolds, as they're gathering all this evidence. And remember, the men from the Delta Force ended up in Mogadishu at the time of the Black Hawk Down episode. We do not know how many of them survived Black Hawk Down, but if you've ever studied it, you realize that of course, it was totally unnecessary, and it had to be ordered from the highest levels of our government because of the men there, the military force there, was under United Nations control. It was not an American force. It was under United Nations control, and they completely went around the chain of command to justify going in after these warlords there in Mogadishu. So somebody at the highest level of our government circumvented the ordinary chain of command in the UN operation, and of course, as a result, at least many of these people from the Delta Force who were there when the Davidians were killed and when the little children were killed, they were there at Mogadishu. That's all we can say. We do not know how many of them were killed, how many of them survived. Tell us what happened, and at least the story of what happened to this church depository there, and why you think that there were explosive charges on the top of that, which could very well have destroyed the children and the women there that were secluded below. What's the background to that story, Mike?
Well, during the course of inserting the CS gas that day, I should back up to the night before. One of the stories told by the Delta Force person that we had with us in the film was that they had an individual who was highly regarded for his surreptitious entry techniques, and he was brought in went into the back of the building on the night of April the 18th. And during the course of events, as he proceeded coming through the gymnasium at the back of the building, he came across one of the Branch Davidians, none other than David Koresh. And he apparently, according to the story we were told in the film, radioed back to headquarters to get permission to grab him and bring him out and to end the siege, in his opinion. And he was told, apparently, our impression is he was given orders by Webster Hubble in the Justice Department that no, they had a plan in place and it was going forward as scheduled, which was the plan that unraveled everything the next morning on April 19th.
But of course, if they'd gotten David Koresh and got him out of there and captured him, why the rest of the Branch Davidians would have given up? They would have come out.
More than likely. I think the issue gets interesting because he was putting what the FBI called overhears, or listening devices, into the building. And in one particular place, and that was the concrete church vault that was located at the base of the four-story tower in the center of the complex. He apparently drilled through the walls, 9 to 12-inch thick walls, steel-reinforced concrete, and placed these listening devices in through the walls, small holes drilled into the wall. These devices were working by mid-morning of April the 19th, and the FBI overheard on the tactical channels the conversation between Dick Rogers and Byron Sage the fellow who was in charge of the overall operation. Had this conversation about overhearing David Koresh and Steve Schneider, his lieutenant, inside of this chamber, this church records vault. And they heard them, and that they didn't have their gas masks on, and that the two Davidians were noting to each other that the gas was okay in there. They could breathe and not have the gas masks on, and everything was dandy. And so the FBI assumed at that point that was going to be the location of Koresh and his lieutenants. In fact, what happened, what we found out in the aftermath, was that Koresh and Schneider went upstairs to where the women and children were.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here. Okay, go right ahead, Mike. And, of course, basically, Snyder and Koresh went upstairs to where the women and children were, and what?
And they ordered the women and the children to go downstairs and to try and shelter in the church records vault, the so-called bunker. As the women and the children were just completing their entry into the church records vault through an open door, a tank, one of the CEVs, came busting through the walls and charged in after the individuals that had just made it into the door. At the point at which the tank came up against the open door of the vault, the tank operator injected a full bottle of CS gas into the room and probably suffocated some of the children. At that particular juncture, the tank then withdrew and ostensibly went over the T-intersection, and this was all occurring about 10:30 in the morning, roughly, and withdrew and went over to the T-intersection where ostensibly to recharge the CS gas tanks. Well, when I watched the footage after that particular point, I noticed something was not right, because when the tanks had been going into the building and inserting CS gas, the crane boom attached to the turret had been facing forward, and the turret gun, the main gun, had been facing backwards. But when this tank returned, it returned and the boom was facing backwards and the gun was facing forward. And I said, okay, what's going on? The tank paused for a moment in front of the hole that had already been made by itself earlier on, and then it roared in and went into the interior of the building. With the turret in that position, what I found out later with study on diagrams of the structure of the tank, the Patton M60 chassis, I found that when the turret was aligned in its forward-facing position, the gun facing forward, it opened up the area where the driver and the radio operator sat and the area of the base of the turret. There was room enough for 3, 4, 5 individuals, where when it was reversed, there was not that space available. So noting that, I noted that the tank went inside of the building and stayed inside for some 10 or 11 minutes. And at that particular point, you have to note that the geography of the building, the ceiling on the first floor, and the floor, base of the second floor, was at the same altitude as the top of the opening of the cupola hatch on the top of the turret. The
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Mike here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and what Mike has pointed out is the fact that apparently that David Koresh and Steve Snyder had gone upstairs, told the women and children to go down and get into the church vault because, of course, it was free of CS gas, and they'd be safe there. And just as the women and children were going in, a tank comes in and injects a full canister of CS gas in where the women and children are, and, of course, Mike feels that many of the children were suffocated at that time, and then the tank goes back and then comes in again, but now it's different. Instead of the gun being, the tank being directed backwards, it's directed forward, and when you do that, you've got room for 3 or 4 extra people there in the tank, and of course the top of the tank would be almost the level of the second floor, which would be the top of the church vault. So pick up the story there, Mike.
Well, when the vehicle went in, knowing that there could be men inside, and at that particular moment the tank and the turret and the geography of the floor plan all matched up, it wasn't what's called in the investigative business an opportunity for something to have happened that shouldn't have. The tank stayed inside the building mysteriously for 10 or 11 minutes and then backed out, waited, and then went back inside and stayed for an additional 10 or 11 minutes. My supposition is that they offloaded personnel to place an explosive device on the roof of the bunker and then extricated them after they had placed their device. That was the means and opportunity for something that followed once the fire had started. Once the fire started, over at the southeast corner of the building, the flames had burned for about 10 or 11 minutes. The fire was fairly fresh. And at that particular juncture, something happened. And when we slowed the film footage made by a TV station down and observed it frame by frame, what we noticed was there was a high explosive detonation on the roof of the concrete vault. And it's distinctly different than what is seen a fraction of a second later, two frames after that. You see that there is what eventually will be ignited, a large plume of propane gas. And what we discovered in evidence later was is that a 100-gallon propane gas bottle had been detached. The top had been cut off with detcord just prior to the fire getting to that location. The gas blevin, the gas unignited, rose into the air so that when the high explosive detonation occurred, and you see this in the film, and our explosives expert, a general from the Air Force, who did the Air Force explosives program in the 60s, watched it, analyzed it, and then it was confirmed by other explosives experts that we had on hand, that indeed the first thing that happened was the tank had to have had the top cut off and the gas released into the atmosphere. And that was probably done by radio control on the device that detonated the detcord around the top. And we had that recovered 100-gallon propane bottle examined by our experts, two of our experts, in the evidence locker. And they said, yes, indeed. I mean, it was very clear. You could see that the top looked like somebody took a blowtorch and just cut right around the top, nice and neat and tidy. And you could see the cut marks into the steel, into the interior, and it blew the top off. Well, at that point, the gas did what it was supposed to do. It went up, and it went up, but it didn't ignite until it was ignited by the high explosive detonation that occurred on the roof. And then, unless you were watching very carefully, which our experts did, you would have thought that the propane was the culprit. It wasn't. There was a high explosive on the roof. We believe it was placed there by the Delta Force operators and or their teammates in the FBI hostage rescue team as a breaching device so as to kill what they thought at the time was David Koresh and his lieutenants in the church records vault. Now, what's interesting about this is you say, well, Mike, how would you know that? How would you know that would cross their minds? Well, it seems that the colonel that led the Delta Force operators, Gerald Boykin, had written a report to his commander, General Peter Schumacher, who later became Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I might add, under Clinton, actually told General Schumacher that they had been asked by Janet Reno and the FBI, if this had been your operation, how would you do it? And they told him what their standard operating procedure is, and that is cut off the head of the snake. In other words, if they had a group like this, whether they were held as hostages or they were willing accomplices, they would go in and surreptitiously execute the leaders of the group and cut off the head of the snake, Koresh and Schneider. And at that particular time, the historical record shows that the FBI thought Koresh and Schneider were in the bunker by themselves. They weren't aware of the children and the women going in. And that an explosive device that was not the property of the Branch Davidians, that was confirmed by both the FBI and the ATF, had detonated on the roof of the bunker, blowing a 20-inch diameter hole with beveled downturned edges, and the steel rebar bent down and into the interior of the room. The room itself blew up like a balloon, and there were stress fractures, the roof was blown up like a balloon, and it was just very obvious that it was a very large penetrating charge that was placed on the roof of the bunker that did not belong to the Branch Davidians.
Oh, do you think then this is what killed the remaining women and children?
Yes. When you look at the videotape and still photos of the recovery of the remains in that room, one of the first things you see is what is left of a standing stainless steel refrigerator, just offset from the blast hole. stainless steel is pretty tough stuff. It takes 32 degrees Fahrenheit to melt stainless steel. This refrigerator was a sagging, melting heap, barely recognizable as a refrigerator. And it was directly just offset of the center of the blast hole. And that meant that the temperature in that room, while it shouldn't have exceeded 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit from the fire itself, did exceed that temperature range and went to more than 3,200 degrees Fahrenheit and melted the stainless steel. The condition, unfortunately, the children were ringed by a group of the mothers, and the children were put in the center of this protective ring of mothers, and unfortunately they were directly under the blast hole and struck by the plasma that was generated into that space, the explosive plasma. And essentially all that was recovered were small pieces of bone, a jaw, a skull or two, a little foot in a little toddler shoe and sock, and the remains of charred bone, leg bones. And it was pretty gruesome.
Well, Mike, if they actually had, you know, their microphones placed in this church vault, you would have think that they would have heard the women and children talking in there if they had those microphones.
But according to the operator's testimony, the microphones went out sometime before the fire started in that locale. And it's interesting because that wasn't the case in the FBI 302 reports that we poured through later. What we found was that those microphones were still operational. However, they went out just before the explosion. And so it seems to me, you have to ask the question, gee, what kind of detonating device was on this explosive? Was it radio controlled? Was it a timer? What was it? Don't know. Because, of course, it was denied that the device even existed. But it was detonated remotely somehow, either by a timer or by a radio control release. And the question would become one of, did the FBI know the women and children were in there? And if so, when did they know and what did they do about it? It reminds me of the Watergate questions. When did you know it and what did you do? Unfortunately, none of that was ever gotten into. That's the deep, dark secret of Waco, that the congressional hearings and the Danforth investigation were designed to cover up so that those questions would never have to be posed.
Well, of course, the thing is, if they knew the women and children were in there and they set off that explosive charge, that would be tantamount to murder.
Well, even if they knew David Koresh and Steve Schneider were in there, it would still be murder.
But, of course, a number of the people there, and I don't know how many of them, I'm sure you know better than I, but a number of the male Davidians, a number of the men, did have bullet wounds that would suggest
well,
that they were
men and women, actually, right. And some of them were shot in the head, some of them were shot in the chest or in the back. And, unfortunately, the ballistics recovery of the slugs, in many cases, did occur. They recovered slugs. And they were of the same calibers used by both sides, 9mm, for example, or 223. And the problem is this. Those recovered ballistics were confiscated by the FBI. We have the coroner of Tarrant County telling us on film that the FBI came in and confiscated all the ballistic evidence before they could conclude their investigation.
Well, I think it would be very important to know whose guns they were. Were they the bullets of the Delta Force? Were they the bullets of the Davidians,
the
FBI?
Here's part of the why. Our friend Jack Danforth came in with much flourish and ceremony and confiscated all the FBI's weapons. All right? But he didn't have the actual slugs recovered from the bodies to compare them to. But he said he did comparative ballistics and everything was cool. Well, compared with what?
Well, of course, I think that Senator Danforth was there not to reveal what happened, but to conceal what happened. And everything has to be concealed. They cannot let the American people know what really happened, because think of the implications. They're plotting in Washington, D.C. to kill the women and children. Or maybe it was just an accident, but why would they be covering up? Why would they keep the fact that the Delta Force was there from the American people? Well, go right ahead, Mike.
Dr. Stan, are we going to have callers this evening?
We will have callers as soon as we get back from this break. How's that?
Okay, that'd be good. I'd love to be able to answer some questions for folks.
Well, we'll open up the telephone calls just as soon as we're at about 3 minutes. So basically, of course, you've told the story. Is there anything else important about the story? I think one of the most important things was what happened to the assistant attorney general who had actually prosecuted the Davidians, who had certainly qualms of conscience and helped you get the evidence for your second film, Waco, The New Revelation. What happened to him?
Bill Johnston was an assistant U.S. attorney. He was the leading prosecutor in the criminal case against the Branch Davidians, beginning with the ATF incident. He helped plan that. He's sort of a hands-on kind of guy. And when things started going sour, particularly after April the 19th, and he saw the way that the FBI behaved, I think our friend Bill Johnston started to get a few pangs of guilt. And he was concerned that maybe he'd been lied to and other people had been lying to. And so while he wasn't in a position to actually point fingers at individuals, he cleared it for us with the Justice Department. And I don't know how he did it, but he did it, for us to go in and look at the evidence that all the criminal proceedings had been completed. The evidence was going to be destroyed. And so he got us permission, and you see him, you see Bill, and some of the Texas Rangers in the evidence locker with myself and Jack Frost, amongst others. And he went to great lengths. And when it was all said and done and Jack Danforth was appointed special counsel, he started interrogating different members of the federal government. And the one person he focused on, and it's not surprising, was our friend Bill Johnston. They ran him through the ringer, and he made a mistake. There was a page in his notes that he had forgotten about that had something about a military projectile or something of that nature that inferred pyrotechnic. And he saw that, never thought of it before as being pyrotechnic, but then in the aftermath and light of this, he made the mistake of removing that page from his notes before he turned them over to Danforth. And that's what they hung him on. They hung him on the idea that he was concealing evidence, which was furthest from the truth. I think he panicked and thought, oh, man, now I'm caught in something that it wasn't my fault. I didn't remember it and didn't think of it. But so he compounded his mistake by removing the page. For that, the consequences were that he was the only public official that was gone after and punished by Jack Danforth in that whole affair. He was the only one. And I think, as more than anything else, as a scapegoat on the part of the government, giving him a little payback for being cooperative in our investigation. As a result, he lost his law license. He lost his position as assistant U.S. attorney. And they were threatening him with jail time, and his attorneys were sharp enough to get him out of that. Eventually, he recovered his law license, and now he practices law in Waco. If I ever needed a good criminal defense attorney, I'd probably pick him because he's honest, which is more than I can say for a lot of attorneys I've met, unfortunately.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I think he was a very courageous figure for having done what he did, for trying to do what was right. And, of course, that's old adage of no good deed will ever go unpunished, at least not if the government has anything to say about it. We'll be back in just a moment with Mike McNulty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Mike McNulty, and he was just telling us the tragic the things that happened to the Assistant Attorney General who tried the Davidians, who tried to bring the truth out after the trial, and, of course, how the government targeted him. Senator Danforth targeted him and said, I wanted to send him to prison. Why? Well, he had made a minor mistake there, but, of course, that was the this was really payback for allowing the information to get out. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you've ever wondered what really happened at Waco, there's nobody who knows this story better than Mike McNulty. So give us a call. Right now we have Bruce calling from Spokane, who'd called in the last hour. We didn't want to interrupt the flow of the conversation. But right now, Bruce, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, I do. I'd like to ask him to give a short synopsis why anybody should care and who cares.
All right, fine. That's a good question.
And ask him that question, and then I'll carry on afterward.
All right, fine. Mike, why should anybody be concerned about what happened at Waco? It was a long time ago. It was, 15 years ago. Why should we be concerned about what happened at Waco?
Dr. Santana probably said it best. If we fail to remember our history, we're doomed to repeat the same mistakes. And, in fact, we've come close to repeating this with the FLDS Church down in Texas. Regardless of what one might say about that group of people, the way things have been handled, and obviously they were handled incorrectly because the Supreme Court of the state of Texas has taken the state government to task and ordered them to return the children. So these kinds of things continue to happen. They will continue to happen as long as government and people in government believe that they can cover their backsides, which did occur during the course of events. If you watch the films, I think you'll come away convinced that this is an unresolved homicide. And you know what? There's no statute of limitations on homicide, Bruce.
One of the things that we've, this program and others like it, there's several news groups and investigative reporters around the country have shown the same thing over and over. It's not only government complicity, but direct government involvement in these high crimes and treason. And they are the artisans for their covering up their own actions and the repressors of the truth. And they're the ones that are going after both witnesses and the others. People have virtually given up on the government. There's a paralyzing malaise out there from all the people that you talk to. They just want to change the subject when you bring these things up.
All right, of course, Bruce, but I really believe that things are going to get very bad in the coming months, financially, certainly. And I believe, of course, we're going to see increasing unemployment. People are going to be losing their homes. They're going to be losing their cars. They're going to be, many people will be on the streets destitute. There are already tent cities springing up across America where people who've lost their homes are going to. And I believe at that time, maybe they're going to begin to care about what happened at Waco, what happened at Ruby Ridge, what happened at the Murrah Building, and maybe what happened
everywhere.
On September 11th.
It's everywhere.
Right.
And
Bruce, one of the things that I think is important is there's a phrase in the Declaration of Independence when Jefferson talks about a long usurpation of power and authority and many trials have befallen the American people and their very long suffering. I think that's an important thing to remember because the consequences, intended and unintended, of these events will form additional events that have consequences. And this kind of thing, if indeed we have a government that, as Jefferson pointed out in the Declaration of Independence, the tree of liberty needs to be revived with the blood of patriots and tyrants from time to time.
Yes, I fully agree with that. There's nothing we can do. Just eat, drink, and be
merry.
We
have to go that route. We have to be right. And many people have to know it. Many people have to have suffered the consequences of these belligerent acts.
And there's plenty that have suffered.
George committed.
Okay, Bruce, well, I appreciate your...
All right,
I share your concern, but our job is to get the truth out, and this is what we do. Your job is to tell people, maybe they don't want to listen, but they're going to know before very long, and I think we're talking about a 6 to 12 months that something's seriously wrong, and they're going to be looking for answers. I want you to be there to tell them, okay?
All right, thanks.
God bless. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I think Bruce is expressing the feeling of frustration that so many people have. Well, I think, of course, we have so many weapons to use, and I'm talking about weapons like Waco, A New Revelation. When you watch this, when you watch Waco Rules of Engagement, and, of course, put this into the proper perspective, you realize that somebody killed 17 little children and the women, and they've never been brought before the bar of justice. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is, of course, Mike McNulty. And we'll, remember, our telephones, well, lines will be open, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, Mike, is anybody out there really today, other than myself and Radio Liberty here, expressing concern about Waco? Are you being asked to be on radio programs about it?
Very infrequently. One of my old friends at KHMC, one of your stations, has had me on the 19th of April. However, there is a film, a feature film with actors and everything, that is going to be going into production very soon, that basically is based on the sum total of the results of my investigations into the Waco incident. And it will be coming out in probably a year, maybe a year and a half, maybe two. And it'll be interesting to see what the public's reaction to it is. And at that particular point in time, I'm also hoping that there'll be a re-release of Waco, New Revelation, amongst others, and that, you know, people will begin to ponder these things and think about them. Now, it's fascinating to me because I've had the opportunity to speak before groups of university students. And we're talking youngsters that are in their 20s now, early 20s, that were in, you know, 10, 11, 12 when the Waco incident actually occurred. And they had absolutely no knowledge of what happened. And they were totally astounded, blown away, so to speak, by the information in the film. And in fact, in some of the universities that I've appeared in Texas, I've actually taken them on tours the following day from my lecture of Mount Carmel and showed them the place where all this transpired. And by the time we were done on our way, they were a bunch of joyous, celebrating life youngsters. And by the time we left, they were a very quiet, bemused crowd of thoughtful individuals. So I'm hoping that maybe someday we'll have some more interest on the part of university professors in looking at this and bringing it before their youngsters in government classes and history classes and filmmaking classes. I would hope people would pay attention to it until someday something appropriate happens. Now, I'd like to point out a couple of things that sort of irritate me. One would be that George Bush has been president of the United States for almost 8 years now. At the time, he was...
Hold us off. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, of course, Mike McNulty. Mike was just saying that one of the things that irritates him is that President Bush has been the president for almost 8 years, but at the time of Waco, he was, what was he at that time?
Well, he was about to take the governorship of Texas away from Ann Richards. And one of the things that could and should have been done at that point was to take a look at the lackluster role that the state of Texas played. And why that was so? Well, it was so because Ann Richards had been told by the Clinton administration, back off. Leave it alone. We don't want to know what the Texas Rangers know. We don't want the public to know. So she was the instigator of the intervention, if you will, by the executive branch in the state of Texas. And when then-Governor George Bush had the opportunity to do that, didn't happen. Then he ran for the White House and lo and behold became president, not once but twice. And still, the opportunity to rectify a grave wrong never came up. Why not?
Oh, I think that there is no statute of limitations on murder, and somebody's responsible for the murder of the 17 little children, and their mothers huddled over them to protect them, and then of course comes the terrible explosion.
Well, there's no statute of limitation on right. homicide in the state of Texas or any other state in the union.
Amen to that. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Before we go on, Mike, do you have a website? Is there any website where people could go to get more information?
Oh, I wished I did. Unfortunately, time and lack of money have worn me down a bit, and what we used to have is not there anymore. Although, I am told, the website for Waco, A New Revelation by the MGA Studios people who produced the film, executive produced it, is still up. So if you put in MGA Films Waco into your search engine, it would take you to that website. I believe it's the first entry that comes up.
All right, and of course, we do have the video. We have the DVD, Waco, A New Revelation. And right now, let's go to Ken, who's calling from California. Hi, Ken. How are you doing?
Yeah, good evening. I got open with a comment that in 2001, I had the pleasure and occasion to meet a late gentleman by the name of Al Magnus, who gave me a copy of all three of the films you're speaking of this evening.
In fact, I knew Al Magnus. He was a good man.
Yeah.
They, at the time I viewed them, had to be the most powerful documentaries I had ever seen in my life, including that short 35-minute one that you mentioned. That was
actually, it was Al Magnus who paid for the making of that film.
Right.
That even that short one was just as powerful as the first two, but you really have to watch all three of them in sequence to understand the power of the third one.
Well, I think that, Ken, this is the reason we've kept them in stock, and we've just put in a new store of a stock of the DVD on A New Revelation. We don't want people ever to forget that until the perpetrators have stood before the bar of justice. I suspect that many of the Special Forces people have already stood before the bar of justice, but a different bar of justice, but those that are still out there and the people of the Clinton administration still alive, they're responsible, and they're going to have to answer in this life or the next one. Anything else, Ken?
Well, when you see in that film the FLIR footage of U.S. government agents laying on their bellies with sniper rifles shooting at U.S. citizens, it turns your stomach. It absolutely turns your stomach.
Right.
We lost our government in the 90s. What Bush is doing to us now is merely the Nazi timeline takeover of the country.
Amen.
That's it. And so I guess my question for Mike is, was the evidence that you uncovered in the making of these three films, did you make any attempt to get that involved in the impeachment of Bill Clinton? And the follow-up question to that is, would you see any relevance of throwing this into the current impeachment proceedings that Dennis Kucinich has entered against George Bush?
I'm not sure that it would be relevant to Bush's impeachment. From the standpoint of Bill Clinton's impeachment, yes, the information was presented. I wrote, I forget how many pages, I think it's about 20 pages, a 20-page report on the FLIR project and the results of all that, and presented it to a congressional investigative committee that was tangential to the Clinton impeachment, and nothing ever made its way to the fore. I don't think, I mean, based on the outcome, I have to look back and say that those people didn't have the cojones to do the job that needed to be done, and they let old Billy off. They impeached him, but they did not remove him from office. And it was the Senate and Arlen Specter, amongst others, who let him off the hook. I don't know why, except that it tends to bolster the concept that elected office, high elected office, is a good old boys club, and if you don't belong to it, then you must be one of the people.
Amen to that. Anything else you wanted to say there, Ken, before we let you go?
No, that's it.
God bless.
Thank you.
And thanks very much. And you get everybody there where you live listening to our program, will you?
Sure do.
God bless. And let's go to Jeannie calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jeannie. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Well, this is extremely informative program, Dr. Stan. And you should have it as the tape of the month.
We would, except it's 2 hours. We do have a one-hour interview with Mike. We may use the tape of the month, but the information is vitally important. You're absolutely right.
I was always curious. This wonderful woman, Janet Reno, after she left office, what did she do and what is she doing now?
Well, as far as I know, she occasionally gives lectures to the local Rotary Club or whatnot, and she lives down in Florida. She moved back home to be with her elderly mother. I believe her mother has passed on now. As you probably know, she's been battling Hodgkin's disease, and the tremors are pretty bad. They were pretty bad back then. I would imagine, the stress of the whole thing. Everybody likes to look at Janet and point a finger at her and say she was the dirty rat. No, actually, she was the fall guy and the front man for Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary, and a man named Vincent Foster, and a man named Webster Hubble in the Justice Department that worked for her. Those were the real culprits. And she, my favorite cartoon of the period, was a picture of Janet, her head mounted on top of a large brick wall that was formed her body, and it had shell holes in it and dings and, you know, chunks blown out, and peering from behind this wall of defense is William Jefferson Clinton. And that's exactly what happened. Janet, on April the 19th, at the crucial hour when things started really going south at Mount Carmel that day, the day of the fire, Janet was dismissed by Webster Hubble and by Floyd Clark, the deputy director of the FBI, and told to go on about her business of a speaking engagement in Maryland with a group of federal judges. And so they sent her off so that the dirty work could be accomplished, so she would have no knowledge of it and thereby be the perfect defender of the aftermath of what happened and taking all the fall guy blame for William Jefferson and company. The woman is despicable to that degree, but I know for a fact that she wasn't directly involved in the decision-making process that led to the fire and death of all the Davidians. She simply excused herself and was out of harm's way while the real dirty work was accomplished by those other individuals.
And I think, of course, the thing is that when she once accepted responsibility, she should have resigned. I mean, that's what everybody else would have done if they're responsible for the death of 17 little children and I don't know how many women. But, of course, she didn't resign. She was allowed to just stay on. She says, I'm responsible, and I'm just going to stay right on here. That's the question.
I have to say it was... The whole situation was masterfully played. The public was masterfully played.
We are always masterfully played. Jeannie, do you have anything else you wanted to say?
I was reading a little excerpt in the newspaper regarding they were thinking of Janet Reno having an office under Obama if he gets president. Was that just something that they put in the newspaper and no credibility to that?
I would say that's more... speculation than anything else. I think she's too sick and a bit old. And I don't think her game would be up for more of that kind of...
Right. Thank God we're rid of her anyway.
Hillary,
she's pounding the pavement and...
Thanks very much, Jeannie. And anything else you want to say before
we
let
you go? Fine.
All right, fine. And Mike, did you tell me the other day that the woman who that somebody who's on the Obama campaign, you know, is actually
a young lady who was the chief of staff of Hillary's election campaign until she discontinued it, was hired last week by the Obama campaign to head up the staff for whoever the vice presidential candidate is going to be.
Isn't that interesting?
It will surprise you if that turns out to be Hillary.
I would think that it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And let's go to Charles calling from Harlem, New York. Hi, Charles. How are you doing tonight?
How are you, Dr. Stan? Grace and peace to you and your guests. Thank you so much for what you do. Quick question. I've always heard little rumor chanting about CIA provocateurs or any kind of intelligence involved with Dave Koresh. Can you give me some feedback? I'll listen off the air. Thank you, guys.
Some of it was very much in the open. The ATF undercover operators that lived across the street a couple of days before the February 28th raid by the BATF, several ATF agents went out back behind the gymnasium area and to the shooting range with David and some of the others, and were out back shooting with each other and having a good time, swapping guns. And David was shooting the ATF's guns, and the ATF was shooting his guns, and it would have been a perfect opportunity to take him into custody right then and there. They didn't. There's also long-held suspicions that there was one or more Branch Davidians who were feeding the BATF information about what was going on inside the Branch Davidian group. Can't attest to that personally. I didn't go down that road, didn't find anything that really led me that way. There was also two individuals that I believe, at least one of which, Jesse Amen, and I can't remember the other individual's name, simply were allowed to walk into the building and stay with the Branch Davidians up until the 18th of April, interesting date, so the day before everything went down. Both of those individuals managed to get out of the building the day before the April 19th fire, but they just walked in, and you hear them on audio tape bugs talking with the Branch Davidians and stirring things up, and it's rather interesting, and there's a lot of supposition that they were plants.
Well, do you think they were actually encouraging them not to come out and not to send the children?
I think they were rabble-rousing. Most definitely they were rabble-rousing, the tapes that I've heard. So you wonder, gee, what in heaven's name is going on here? Now, the FBI denies it, of course, and says those individuals just snuck through their heavily guarded perimeters. And, you know, for example, the press did their best to get in there and conduct some interviews, and they never could do it. But these two guys, these two, quote, Yahoo hayseeds, just sort of wandered in and managed to get through the perimeters and go talk to these folks. Spent several days with them.
Of course, you wonder why they would allow them inside there. You would think they would have been smart enough to be suspicious of them.
Well, the Branch Davidians apparently didn't seem to think so. Just thought they were more of the awakened public trying to find out what was going on. So I don't know.
Business
surrounds this whole incident.
We will probably never know a lot of the things, but certainly there should be an independent investigation. The congressional investigation was obviously a cover-up. Anybody who saw that would know that. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. If you have a question or comment for our special guest tonight, Michael McNulty. Mike, looking back, it's been a long time that you've been involved. If you had it to do all over again, would you do it the same way, or do you think maybe you'd been a lot smarter and a lot wiser just to have put it to one side and gone on with your life?
No, I think my persistence and the amount of time that transpired were the reasons why so much of what we did find came about. I wish there was a number of things I wished I had handled differently. I was going through my telephone book that I put together about the Waco incident, and I noted how many people that had been involved in this thing, directly or indirectly, during the course of events and after, have died. And we're not talking about old people who just lived out their existence. We're talking about some pretty young people and some people that just were not in a position to need to die. Okay, they were in good health and young. But they did. They died under strange circumstances, most of them. Blood poisoning, alleged heart attacks in people who had never had any heart condition. They were in their 30s or 40s. And I was amazed at how many people had died during the course of the past 10 years or so.
Sort of like after the Kennedy assassination, sort of like after the assassination of Martin Luther King and others, almost a recurrent pattern. Now, one of the things you mentioned on a previous program is that all of the Davidians are finally out of jail. How did that happen?
Yes.
Because some of them were sent there for 40 years.
They had served their complete sentences, plus time for misbehavior, some of them. People like Paul Fatta and some of the others. A couple of them, Graham Craddock and Paul Fatta, I had been privileged to interview in federal prison during the course of their time serving. And those were hard interviews to do. It was interesting to be in a federal prison doing those interviews. But they appear, many pieces of them appear in the Waco A New Revelation film. Now Paul is back out. I believe he's running a restaurant out in California. with one of his friends, and Graham has been returned, expatriated back to Australia, and he works with his father and mother. You know, all these folks are trying to get on about their lives, and the government doesn't make it easy for them. They're not allowed to talk to one another. They're not allowed to be involved with or talk with people who might be construed as enemies of the state, so to speak. You know, people like me, they're not supposed to talk to me. And it gets strange. It's like, gee, can they do that? Well, in fact, convicted felons, they can do all kinds of things, too.
So we're out of time. Our guest has been Mike McNulty, and of course we're talking about Waco, A New Revelation. We'll be right back to wrap up our program. Well, Mike, we got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the marathon this evening.
Well, I would just like people to remember that there is no statute of limitations on murder. And the Texas Rangers believe, that worked on this case, that this is an open homicide. I believe it also. And I think the evidence that you'll see in the films that Dr. Stan is offering also will tell you that. I would encourage you that even if you're an FBI agent or an ATF agent, you're listening to this program, and you have your doubts, obviously, get copies of the films and take a look at them for yourselves. You judge. There's an old adage that was repeated in a film by Groucho Marx called Duck Soup, where he gets caught in bed with a lovely blonde, platinum blonde flapper, and his ugly hag fish-faced wife catches him in bed, and she comes in and she's just reading him the riot act, and Groucho stops her in mid-sentence and says, okay, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?
I love
and
that.
I think that's the issue. Are you going to believe your favorite Uncle Sam in the current configuration of the Bush administration and or the Clinton administration? Or are you going to believe your lying eyes when you see the evidence brought forward before you?
And, of course, really, the tragic thing is it didn't have to happen. I mean, there were many opportunities to have arrested David Koresh. He had invited the BATF agents to come out and come in and go through his place there. Of course, they could have come in. They could have arrested him. They could have arrested him. When they were out shooting with him, the FBI could have arrested him. He went out running every morning, and, of course, they could have arrested him then. They didn't want to arrest him. They wanted an incident. They wanted to get publicity for the BATF, and of course
I think they got a little more than they bargained for.
But of course, nobody's ever been held responsible, Mike. This is what really bothers me more than anything. If you're a government agent and you kill somebody, you get away with it. If you're working with a prison,
we refer to it, the folks I've met in the investigations, etc., as a license to kill.
Amen to that.
It authenticated an FBI or a federal agent's license.
And, of course, we don't issue those 007 licenses. There may be a few people working within intelligence who are working in other countries who have a license to kill, but you do not have a license to kill in the United States. I don't think our agents should ever have a license to kill anybody, because that is a decision that should be left up to God, not to government. Mike, thank you for everything you've done. I really appreciate you being with us, and hopefully one of these days, again, we can get you back. But right now, we're going to give you a little repass, and we're going to see if we can get people to watch your videos. They're great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Michael McNulty. If you'd like to get copies of this program, and we have one other recent interview with him, they're very important. But even more than that, the DVDs, Mike doesn't get anything out of them. They're put out by somebody else, but he has certainly volunteered to appear on our program to try to keep this issue alive in the hearts and minds and souls of our people. The DVDs, pardon me, the initial VHS or video is called Waco, A New Revelation. We have it. Waco, I should say Waco, The Rules of Engagement. We have it as VHS. We have Waco, The New Revelation. That's available on DVD. Then, of course, we have The FLIR Project, which is still available on video. We've had these for a long time. We want people to watch them. And you cannot understand what happened at Oklahoma City. You can't understand the downing of TWA 800. You cannot understand what we are told happened on September 11, 2001, unless you understand that governments lie to their people. They have a different agenda. They have a different goal. And if they could get away with killing the 17 little children at Waco and 168 people there at, at the Murrah Building, and, of course, several hundred people on the downing of TW-800. Is it conceivable that they were somehow involved in what happened on September 11th? All we need to do, of course, is look at Building 7 coming down, and we begin to understand that this was a controlled demolition. It came down at 5:20 in the afternoon. It wasn't hit by any airlines at all. And as you watch the DVDs, why, of course, you'll see the center of Building 7 collapse. The center of the building collapses, and that's what you do when you are taking a controlled demolition. And then the basement of the building dissolves, and the building falls at the speed of gravity, a controlled demolition. So how did Osama bin Laden do that? And if he didn't do that, how did the government do that? And if the government or somebody or an intelligence agency did that, then what really happened to the Twin Towers? And there's so many unanswered questions out there. Everything is done to confuse you, but understand, ladies and gentlemen, this was a watershed event. And, of course, as Condoleezza Rice said, and she actually said this before the 9-1-1 commission when they were questioning her, and she was asked, why didn't the government do anything? And when she replied, and you'll find this on page, I believe, 181 of the book, Without Precedent, the story of the 9-1-1 commission, Rice pointed out that the nation simply wasn't prepared to take dramatic action against Al-Qaeda before 9-11, either abroad or in reforming government here at home, and said, until there is a catastrophic event that forces people to think differently, that forces people to overcome all customs and old culture and old fears about domestic intelligence, you don't get that sort of change. Well, September 11th gave that sort of change. You can get these quotations, certainly they're in my little pamphlet entitled The True Story of 9-1-1. You need to get our three pamphlets on Foreknowledge 9-1-1. We have so much information out there. We got a great new DVD. It's called Blueprint for Terror. And, of course, it's put out by the architects and engineers for 9-1-1 Truth. That's Blueprint for Terror. You'll want to get 9-1-1 Mysteries. You'll want to get the DVD entitled In Plain Sight. They're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. Do you know that 1,100 bodies have never been recovered from the debris of the Twin Towers collapse? 1,100 bodies. What happened to them? If those building pancaked, they should have been crushed. Or were they vaporized when the building exploded? And you see massive beams, weighing, 10, 20, 30 tons shooting out sideways and embedding in adjacent buildings. Do you honestly believe that was a pancake? Or when, of course, massive beams are thrust into the sides of adjacent buildings? Well, ladies and gentlemen, our number 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Get the information on Waco. Get the information on 9-11. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. We're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle for the survival of humankind.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.